Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 16, Cloud Computing and EULA Law. This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcast.com/TWiL. And by GoToMeeting. For a month of unlimited online meetings, absolutely free, go to GoToMeeting.com/TWiL. And by listeners like you. Thanks so much for your contribution. We couldn't do TWiT without it. We'd like to thank Victor Cajau for help with this podcast. You can listen to Victor's own podcast, The Typical Mac User, at typicalmacuser.com/WordPress and Immigration Tales at immigrationtales.com.
Hi there, welcome back to TWiL. This is episode 16, and today we're going to do something that I have been wanting to do for a while, which is answer some listener mail, which will also, I hope, give us the chance to go through some current stories that aren't in the mailbag because they relate to some of the things that are. And we've got some old hands here at TWiL with us today. We've got Ernie Svensson down in New Orleans. Welcome back to the show, Ernie.
Thanks for having me back. Good to be here.
And Marty Schwimmer in New York. Marty,
hey,
thanks, thanks for coming back.
Good to be here.
And joining us for the first time today is Nikki Black, also in New York. Nikki, great to have you on the show.
Thanks so much.
And Evan Brown from Chicago. Evan, great.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you on board. I'm really excited to finally get around to answering some of our listener mail, and I'm realizing that I have been remiss in giving out my email address on the show. I hardly ever do it. I don't know if I've ever done it, but people managed to track me down anyway, which is great. I'm so glad to hear from the folks who listen to the show, and we definitely enjoy hearing what legal issues are on your mind and helping us think about content for the show. So my address is dhowell@gmail.com, and I really do appreciate it when folks email us with thoughts, feedback, questions, whatever you may have, with the caveat, of course, that we can't actually give you specific legal advice unless, of course, one of us takes you on as a client, and then more power to you. But
yeah, God help you.
Yeah. But we do enjoy thinking about the issues that you might raise. So do email into the show and let us know what's on your mind, as some other people have done. In fact, one thing that is much on everybody's mind this week, or at least folks who are into technology, is the new 3G iPhone. And hey, did any of you wait in line and grab yourself an iPhone last Friday or thereafter?
I waited in line and then got out of line because it was just too much.
Nobody else was brave enough?
I'm standing here, I'm sitting, holding my BlackBerry Curve in my hand, quite satisfied that I'm above all of this.
Ah, I see. How about you, Nikki?
I didn't even risk it. I'm going to give it 6 months.
Yeah, I think I'm probably going to do the same thing, especially because my 2G, I guess they would be called now, iPhone, managed to update its firmware after a really long delay and added the App Store, which is pretty cool, and you can still have on your old phones. So I've been happily downloading apps, either for free or for... Most of them are pretty reasonably priced, it seems like. But the one thing I do have a question on from a legal front that I haven't put to the test yet is if I do bite the bullet and get one of these 3G ones to get the increased network speed, I don't know if the App Store lets you transfer those programs over. I don't know how the licensing on that works. So that's something to look into, because if you plunk down $10 for an app and then you have to do it again when your old iPhone is going on the scrap heap, that seems kind of excessive.
No, I think it's going to let you do that because, for one thing, once you've downloaded it, if you delete it from your computer, you're always allowed to download it later through iTunes. So I think it's just tagged to your account. So it's not about the phone. It's about your account with iTunes.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. That's actually far more progressive than software licenses can be, you know, where they lock you down to one or a few computers. So we will see. how that all works. But anyway, one thing that has been much on the mind of iPhone users is before this App Store came along, the only way you could get applications, well, there were two ways to get applications on your iPhone. One would be to use the web apps, which you can still use and which I really enjoy, actually. I use, a bunch of Twitter apps that you access via just the web browser on the iPhone. And of course, you could unlock your iPhone and that would give you the option of downloading applications for it and also possibly connecting it to another carrier. But of course, that's against what Apple wants you to do with the iPhone. And so folks have written in specifically, let's see, Ed Andino wrote in to say that he's read a few testimonials on the internet stating that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act of 1996 has an exemption that allows a person to unlock their cell phone as long as they are legally connecting to their phone to a wireless network. I have included that exemption of the DMCA below, even though I know you have read it many times. I have not heard any podcasters, copyright experts, or lawyers speak on this issue. If the DMCA does give us consumers the right to unlock our iPhones, I expect this issue to eventually reach the courts. I thought Europe didn't allow locked cell phones. Have you heard anyone question how Apple has been able to negotiate these exclusive deals with one provider in each European country without causing a backlash from any government agency? Of course, that they're now in Canada, too. I would appreciate any thoughts you have on the unlocking issue. I'm currently using a T-Mobile cell phone. I'm out of contract, so I can switch to AT&T if I wanted to get a new iPhone and follow the Apple AT&T authorizing procedures. But I don't want to get locked into AT&T for 2 years. I prefer to stay with T-Mobile because of my positive experience with the T-Mobile service I've had over the last 4 years. It would be great to unlock the iPhone so I could stay with T-Mobile and not be tied to a contract. So this is something that lots of people are interested in. And yes, you are correct, Ed, that there is an exemption from the DMCA for the express purpose, and that this is from the anti-circumvention portions of the DMCA for the express purpose of connecting to a wireless network in a legal way. Does anybody have any experience with this or any thoughts on the unlocking issue?
Well, this is Evan. I don't have any personal experience, but I mean, I just would make the observation that there has been some litigation over this, and it obviously is problematic. I know that TracFone has been pretty aggressive in filing some lawsuits, a lot of them down in Florida, about, you know, going after consumers who are actually the more on the retail level of buying phones in large batches and unlocking them and putting them out on the market. And the real kind of sticking point seems to be that they don't fall into that exemption from DMCA circumvention liability because these aren't for personal use. So it's interesting to see that whole swarm of litigation going on with TracFone.
Right. There's a provision there that you're not allowed to make money off of your unlocking activities if you're engaging in them.
It just kind of underscores the importance of it being for, you know, just your personal use and not trying to engage in some kind of business for it.
Another person asked me a question about it that I found kind of interesting that didn't have to do with actually engaging in any unlocking activity, but it had to do with showing somebody or teaching somebody how to do that and charging for that service. You know, if you put a tutorial on the web that says, here's exactly step by step how you unlock your iPhone and connect it to another carrier and or download applications, and you can read these instructions for 99 cents or what have you. Interesting to consider whether that would fall within the exemption since. Any thoughts on that, anybody?
Well, you certainly, this is Evan again, you certainly got to worry about running afoul of, I think it's what, 1201B, or I know there are several sections and subsections of the anti-circumvention provisions that talk about the trafficking in those technologies. So yeah, I don't think I've ever read the exemptions with that in mind, but that's certainly the thing you would want to think about, not running afoul of those, even if you're not actually doing the unlocking, but you know, out there spreading the knowledge of how to do that, which is kind of what the concern was last year with Dig and, you know, putting up the decryption code for the DVDs and everything. So
right. Hey Marty, we're gonna add you back in. Or did you drop off on purpose?
No, I did not drop off on purpose.
All right. Hang on.
Ernie was talking about going back to Panama and right in the middle of the word Panama, I got cut off.
Okay, he still is. Hold on just a sec. So TruePhone lets you use Wi-Fi to make phone calls wherever you might be.
Yeah, and I think some people use it to make international calls if they don't want to have an international calling plan from the U.S. But that's not the main benefit, because you can probably get, we could use Skype and you could use lots of things. I mean, for me, the benefit is if I'm going to travel to Panama and I want to call back to the States, in the past, I would have to bring a computer in order to use Skype. And I was doing all that through Wi-Fi. But hey, if I have the iPhone, then I have what I need, is a Wi-Fi connection, and I can use that and call. So I shall be testing it in Panama in less than a week.
Good. Well, keep us posted.
I will.
And are you going to delete any potentially copyrighted works from your iPhone, iPod computer as you travel across international borders?
You know, I've been listening to the chatter about that. Buzz Out Loud, I think, and on Twit, they've been talking about that. Patrick Norton had a description, was talking about how that was going on. Are these isolated events? Because I keep hearing about people being asked to open up their laptops, and if they can't prove that it wakes up, they have to take extra time. Is that really going on in any kind of widespread scale? Because if it is, I think that's it just seems like a problem.
Seems like a Fourth Amendment issue, right?
Yeah. And part of what's going on apparently is, well, there's the whole child pornography thing that is in itself interesting. And I don't know if this wasn't necessarily a topic for discussion, but it's one that I find interesting. There was an article a while back, I think Declan McCullough wrote for CNET or one of those publications, about the FBI doing, baiting people by setting up dummy sites that had child pornography, or sending links out to people that then if they clicked on the link, they would be taken to that site. And if they were taken to that site, then they would be pursued for accessing child pornography. That seemed to me, like one of those things that, on the one hand, I can't believe that they would do it. On the other hand, I guess knowing, things that the government does that are kind of lame-brained, I accepted it. But there was a local doctor in New Orleans who was very reputable, and he was 70 years old, an elder gentleman. He was charged with having child pornography. And I've started to see these charges come up where people are getting charged. And I wonder, how do they know that they have it? And if that's true, that they're using this baiting scheme, and if it's susceptible to being rigged, like if a friend sends you the link, a la Rickrolling, and you click on the link, but you wind up at the site, that would seem to me to be a problem. But from what I've heard, you're charged, they can charge you simply for accessing it. They don't have to prove intent, which I just cannot believe is true.
Well, I definitely think it should be a crime to listen to Rick Astley too much, if that was the point you're trying to make.
But that's a self-enforcing punishment. There's no need for the whole criminal justice system to get involved.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Well, with child pornography, they've been pushing the limits for some time now, and they seem to be ignoring all the protections and bending them, and because it's a crime that the federal government seems to think it's worthwhile to do that for it. They were doing that a while back in 2006 with Google, when they were subpoenaing all the searches, Google and Yahoo, and to find people that were searching for child pornography. They're doing that a lot lately with this particular crime.
That what you're talking about, Ernie, sounds a lot like entrapment. I know there's a criminal defense lawyer on the line. I have no idea what the elements of entrapment are, but I would really be freaked out to just get an email that has a link like that, thinking, well, man, what's going on here?
Yeah. But I don't know how to spell Declan's last name to find the article, but to Google for it, but it's
MCCULAGH, I believe, if I'm remembering that off the top of my head.
Maybe Google will correct me and tell me, did you mean Declan McCullough? Yes, I did. Yeah, well, I guess I would be interested in what Nikki has to say about whether that constitutes entrapment. But from what I understood of the discussion, both on the CNET discussion and the Declan McCullough discussion, they were talking about having read that it was there's no need to prove intent. And I can't fathom that would be true.
Well, that surprises me, because there's very few strict liability, for lack of a better word, crimes. But, entrapment's so fact specific too, and it all depends on the crime and federal versus state. And you know, some things sound like they might be entrapment, but it ends up, you know, that, you know, that it doesn't work that way. So without specific facts in the statute, it's hard to tell based on what you're seeing. And I find the intent issue sort of puzzling as well.
Yeah, I found the CNET link. If you just Google Declan and child pornography, you'll find it. But it's FBI was posting fake hyperlinks to snare suspects.
That's the danger of writing about child pornography, I suppose. Your name is forever associated with it in Google's cache.
I just hope nobody's keeping track of the records of my search queries. Too.
I think they are keeping track.
Oh, yeah.
Well, on their servers.
Well, they definitely are. And there's a big story, you know, that's been in the news the last couple of weeks about the Viacom case and the discovery ruling there. And it actually segues nicely with one of our pieces of viewer mail that is about electronic discovery. Paul Edwards wrote in, "Hello, Denise. I came across your podcast on the Twit TV site a while back, and I wanted to say that I find the show very informative, even if some of it is over my head. It's over our heads too, Paul. Don't worry. I'm not sure if you've done an episode in the past about the new electronic discovery and the changes to the rules of civil procedure that I believe went into effect in late 2006. I work for a nonprofit K-12 organization. There's a lot of confusion as to what needs to be done to be compliant with these new rules. If you haven't done one yet, it would be great if you could take a few minutes on an upcoming show to talk about these changes and what companies and organizations need to do." So this highlights that there are requirements in place, legal and otherwise, that mandate that some records be retained. And one way in which that's come to light recently is in this Viacom case where a discovery request got at a whole bunch of YouTube user information, including, it seems, IP addresses that could, if one were so inclined, allow one to track down particular computers that were viewing the YouTube videos. So we've got FRCP requirements, we've got discovery requirements that people hang on to things. And on the other side, of course, we have a preference that privacy be adhered to and that people not have to keep more information than they need to because it's so onerous to hang on to all that data, specifically when you're talking about something on the scale of a Google. Let's start with the FRCP rules. Have you guys been dealing with this? It's been so long since I've litigated something in the trial courts that this is something that has not been high on my list of things to worry about since it went into effect.
Well, Evan, you went to the Sedona conference and took extensive notes, as I recall, so you should be up on all this.
Well, yes, I did. I'm not, but what you're referring to there is I can't say I got in trouble, but, you know, the powers that be at Sedona conference sent me a friendly email asking me to take down the content I'd posted when I was live blogging at an event in Memphis last year. So that was fun. Interesting experience, but I think I somewhat incriminated myself because while I was live blogging, I acknowledged that they have this Sedona privilege, says, you know, what stays in the Sedona or what happens in the Sedona conference stays in the Sedona conference.
And then anyway, you blogged it.
And then I blogged
it. So, I love it.
You know, it just goes in, you know, comes in the ears and out through the fingers, you know, so.
But from the brief period of time that your comments were up, I read them and they were extensive and it sounds like you learned a lot of cutting edge, interesting stuff at that conference.
Well, I did. Yeah, the Sedona conference is great, of course, and you know it's a great way to learn something. And even though they got angry with me, I'll fully endorse their services because they're, you know, top of the heap when it comes to that stuff. But yeah, I do a fair amount of e-discovery stuff. I'm on our firm's electronic discovery response team. You know, I'm in the business litigation section of our firm. So, you know, a fair amount of what I do on a day-to-day basis is e-discovery. And, you know, as far as making general observations about it, it really is interesting to see how things changed overnight, you know, on or about December 1st, 2006, when the new rules went in effect, in relation to how attorneys treat electronic discovery and the importance to put on it. And what was particularly interesting to see was this emergence of what I characterize as, you know, the sky is falling kind of mentality. Oh my gosh, you know, we've got these new rules. We've got these problematic decisions coming from New York, you know, the Zuba Lake opinion saying there's an affirmative duty of counsel to go out and do things. So, you know, after the rules went into effect that whole time, you really saw this renewed emphasis. And it was particularly frustrating dealing with opposing counsel who, you know, weren't necessarily up on the rule changes or, you know, had been to a CLE and heard about them, but weren't, you know, up on the technology involved, because, you know, it's just easy to be obstreperous when you don't understand what's going on. So that was frustrating. But, you know, we're out now, gosh, you know, over a year and a half since the rule changes have gone into effect. And there's been a shakeout to a certain extent. People aren't as generally uptight. You know, it's obviously good to be cautious and be diligent, both when you are advising a client as to what to preserve and ultimately produce, but also being, you know, a zealous advocate trying to get information. So the point I'm trying to make is it's nice to see things level out and plateau a little bit as far as the level of zeal going into all this stuff.
So two questions, Evan. First, what's the Sedona Conference so folks know what we're talking about?
Well, I'm not a member and, you know, I am not endorsed by them. I guess it's like
the Woodstock for e-discovery.
Right. Everybody goes there and you bring food to share with everybody. Now, it's a nonprofit organization, I guess. It's a think tank is how I consider it. If you go to SedonaConference.org, that's the best way to learn about it. But they deal with matters other than just electronic discovery, you know, addressing issues with, you know, antitrust and other, you know, areas of litigation. But the Sedona principles are a set of guidelines and best practices for e-discovery, and they're now in their second edition. The shorthand way that I refer to the Sedona principles is like the restatements for, you know, electronic discovery. There are nice, concise principles that talk about the best practices when it comes to the preservation of evidence and the production and, you know, the scope of discovery when it comes to electronically stored information. And, you know, there's some commentary and annotations that go with that are very helpful, kind of like, you know, e-discovery lawyer in a can if you're, you know, kind of at a starting point for, you know, handling an e-discovery issue.
Right. And the head of the Sedona Conference, at least the e-discovery part, is Ken Withers, who was working for the Federal Judicial Center during the six or so years preceding the adoption of the new federal rules. And he knows a lot about this because he worked hand in glove with the you know, the major shapers of those new rules, and he's written an article which you can download if you look, you know, Google Ken Withers. I think it was in the Notre Dame Law Review or one of those law reviews, but it's online, free of charge, in PDF form, and that is the easiest to read, most comprehensive, lively. I know it sounds strange to say about a law review article, but it actually is very entertaining and interesting, and he has a very keen grasp of the dynamics underlying electronic information, and he's very good at explaining it. So,
right, he's a very good, and, you know, lively is a very apt description, you know, for his speaking style too. You know, very interactive and knowledgeable, and it's strange that one can make e-discovery, you know, at least somewhat interesting like he does.
Okay, so now that we know about these rules, can anybody tell me in a nutshell, first, how they changed the lay of the land, and second, what people need to be concerning themselves with under the new regime?
Well, as to whether they changed the lay of the land, I'll tell you this story. This is a local federal magistrate who I've known for a number of years. He's a real procedural maven, loves procedure. And he knows that I'm interested in technology. And one day he pulled me aside and said, "So you think that these electronic discovery rules are so great?" He goes, "I don't see that they change anything." He says, "I don't see what the difference with e-discovery is." And I've heard that question asked a lot of times. And I think that that's a valid question. And part of the rules changes, it doesn't change underlying discovery. You know, discovery is about getting information and figuring out how to make use of it and figuring out how to get it admitted when you use it at trial. And that didn't change. What's changed, and this has nothing to do with law, is the technology has made it such that more and more information is being stored electronically. Less of it is being converted to paper. In the case of emails, there's only 67% of emails. 67% of emails are never printed out. Now, why the other 33% are, I don't know. But that's important information that doesn't get printed out. And then the question becomes, how can you ask for that? Do you want a native format? And so the federal rules really are just a way to kind of create organization about how to get at these sources of information, which are now predominant. And so in some sense, they didn't really change anything. But by virtue of passing new rule changes and making people aware that there are new sources of information, that to me has been the biggest event. The fact that people think that they have to learn new rules, and of course they do, but really what they need to do is learn how to deal with digital information. That's where all of the problems occur. These cases where you see adverse inference rulings being entered or large sanction awards being entered is because the lawyers don't talk to the techies, or they don't understand what's going on in the underlying realm of technology. That isn't going to go away because of the federal rules.
Yeah, and to reiterate what you said, Ernie, there, you're right. And for all intents and purposes, the federal rules don't change the law when it comes to e-discovery. I mean, of course, they're all rules of procedure, of course. For example, the duty to preserve evidence, which is such a hot issue and such a something that'll really keep you up at night, in dealing with electronically stored information. I mean, that's a common law doctrine that's nowhere expressed, in the rules or the amendments. I think to crystallize it, at least in my mind, of how the new rules change things is they force litigants to give it earlier attention and more detailed attention, with the things that you're supposed to talk about at the Rule 26F conference, for example. And they just bring everything up more into the forefront. Earlier attention, more detailed attention, and the catalyst has been to, make it more efficient, hopefully.
And to deal with certain situations like inadvertent disclosure, which is much more likely to occur when you're managing electronic information, the rules provide for clawback provisions if you inadvertently produce something and say,
Did you just say clawback?
Yeah, that's what they call it, believe it or not. In fact, I'll tell you, it's funny. I have this friend he's not a techie. He's in the Stone Age. And he calls me up one day and he says, I just came back from the Electronic Discovery Conference and it's really great because I learned a lot of stuff. I said, well, what did you learn? He goes, clawbacks rock.
So that would literally be clawing back something that you let escape.
Right. Yes. And, it's usually addressed in a protective order, how you're going to handle that. And it is critical to have these kinds of things addressed, because one of the hallmarks of the discovery of electronically stored information is the volume of material that we're talking about. Just to get back to our Viacom versus YouTube case here, the opinion talked about the actual data that was at issue here. I think it was the log files, talking about 12 terabytes of data here. I mean, clearly you can't be, and that's an exceptional situation, but, even in an average, $100,000 commercial litigation case, it's unreasonable to think that counsel or a paralegal is going to be able to review every single page of electronically stored information that's going out before it's shipped off. You've got to rely on technological means to sort out privileged stuff in most instances. So it is critical, to preserve attorney-client privileges, that there are that the whole notion of being able to claw back stuff is in there.
In New York lately, there have been a lot of issues with metadata and the inadvertent release of it in different sorts of documents, and there have been a lot of cases on that as well. So that's another issue that is starting to come up. People don't even realize it's there, and they're releasing these documents, and the opposing counsel finds it.
Right. And then there's questions about whether it's ethical to look into metadata that you think the other side might have inadvertently produced.
Right. Right. There's the decisions are going in. There's ethics decisions from different bar associations, and they're going in different directions on that. I think the ABA and the New York City Bar Association came down on opposite ends of that. So.
Sure. So the problem here for folks who aren't familiar with what can be in the data, the metadata of a legal document, is suppose you've been going back and forth with your client and you're pushing for a settlement. You think your client's being outrageous and your client's saying, no, 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 never. And you're saying, but we'll never win this. And all of this is documented very well in what you've been sending back and forth in the notes or the comments to the document you've been drafting, or something maybe quite not so damning. But
right. The actual real world example that would more likely occur with metadata, because that example of the track changes in a Word document, that's what everybody uses as an example. But I don't really consider that metadata. I mean, it is in a sense, but and it can be metadata. But what's more likely to happen, and I have seen this, is if somebody sends a document to somebody and purports that that was their document that they created, when in fact what they did was get the document originally from somebody else and then pass it off as their own, that you can pick up because you'll see who the original creator of the document is. And that's the sort of thing that is definitely embedded in metadata.
Right. And another example closely akin to that is, you know, the timing of when someone may have known something. You know, if one of the elements of the case is knowledge, you know, knowledge of something before taking a certain act, that can be shown by, you know, the created on date or the modified date or something like that. So, yeah, a good use for it there.
So we've got, on the one hand, these new discovery rules in place, new as of 2006. And on the other hand, we've got scads of lawyers out there in the world advising clients, you know, as vehemently as possible, don't hang on to stuff because it can come back to haunt you. You know, within the bounds of what's legal, don't hang on to stuff. So how do these two things come together and relate, or do they?
That can create a problem because, in fact, there are cases, well, because of the litigation hold problem, that, you know, if there is litigation, you are not, or litigation is anticipated, you are not permitted to destroy evidence that would be relevant to that litigation. And, you know, this is formalized when lawyers or their clients send litigation hold requests saying there's going to be litigation, or there is, and we want you to preserve all documents related to whatever. And it's usually an overbroad request, and there can be fighting about that. But if you have in place, and this is what companies, one company in particular, I forget the name of the case, but had in place a policy where they would automatically delete emails that were in the trash within 7 days. Well, it wasn't feasible or easy for them to reverse that process. And so they lost some emails that were relevant to the request, and they got into trouble for doing that. So yes, you want to set up systems to get rid of information and purge it. But if you're too quick to do it, you might inadvertently run afoul of one of these litigation hold requests. And the problem in e-discovery, and this is really where people get into trouble, it's kind of like the cover-up is worse than the crime. When you violate one of these provisions, something bad is going to happen. And in the case involving Ron Perlman, and now the name of it is escaping me. Help me out, Evan. The Sunbeam versus, he was buying Sunbeam stock, Coleman and Morgan Stanley. The Morgan Stanley case, the problem there was, you know, to prove a fraud case, you have to prove fraud, reliance, and damages. Well, when these backup tapes weren't produced and there was problems with the backup tapes, and the judge said, well, that's it. You screwed up. We're going to enter an adverse inference ruling, and we're just going to tell the jury they can assume fraud. Okay, now you go to trial, and he has to prove he relied on the fraud and that he had damages. So he did. Now, ultimately, that case got reversed. You know, that's the problem. If you trigger the violation, then you often wind up with a far worse result than if you had just done, you know, like if Morgan Stanley had turned over the emails in the backup tapes, it would have taken forever for the plaintiffs to sift through them. There probably wouldn't have been any smoking gun there. You know, it would have been better, ironically, than to violate the rule.
Ernie, this is probably a good time to make an observation about one of the new rule changes. 37E. Which says that a party can't, or the court can't sanction a party for any electronically stored information that's lost. Well, I have it right here. Lost as a result of the routine good faith operation of an electronic information system. So that seems to fit into that hypothetical that you were talking about where, you know, reversing that 7-day deletion period. I think that if the producing party could demonstrate that it was trying its best to preserve the evidence in light of the reasonably anticipated litigation and reversing that document or that information retention schema, you know, it'd probably be okay under that there.
What happens when you're a company like Google that, you know, is facing however many hundred of lawsuits at any given time? Your litigation hold obligations must be fairly extreme, right? Because anything that you do in the routine course would probably be viewed as in violation or possibly relevant to some pending action.
Oh, I was just taken aback because I didn't realize anybody was suing Google. That's why I didn't answer.
I wonder how they manage that situation. Obviously, they and other companies are in the very interesting position of probably wanting to purge a lot of data for various reasons.
Sure.
Also wanting to hang on to a lot of data because it's so valuable to the way that they do business to be able to leverage that data and build out new services based on it.
Right. And you can't forget that some data has an exculpatory effect as well, saying, look, we weren't doing anything bad. So
absolutely.
But I mean, even, you know, companies unlike Google, or, you know, smaller than Google face litigation all the time. And this is probably a cop-out kind of answer, but there's got to be some kind of rule of reason, you know, what's reasonable, given the resources of the company and, you know, being able to examine whether or not there is reasonably anticipated litigation that would involve this data set here. And, you know, other than that, it would just be kind of a case-by-case analysis. You just got to, of course, comply with the laws that are in place, whether it be Sarbanes-Oxley or HIPAA or Gramm-Leach-Bliley or, you know, the statute of limitations for a breach of contract action. It's just got to be a mix of all these things and all of this kind of a template laid on top of the resources that you have and the ability to manage that kind of system.
Was anybody surprised by the scope of this order in the Second Circuit case, the Viacom versus YouTube case?
I was just going to say, I already observed that 12 terabytes is a lot of data.
Right. So that's volume. But how about what they're actually being allowed to see? The fact that there are privacy implications here.
This morning, Evan, and I'll give Evan credit, he was kind enough to point this out to me, that they entered into a stipulation and limited the amount of data that's actually going to be turned over. So now it's no longer the IP addresses and individual usernames. Now they're going to create sort of a unique.
Oops, we lost Uh-oh. Nikki.
Wonder if we should try her phone.
Yeah, let me see if I can get a landline for her. But Evan, why don't you enlighten us as to the stip? I wasn't aware.
Well, I think they agreed to anonymize the data is the essence of it.
Uh-huh.
The big privacy, you know, concern is, oh my gosh, you're seeing what I watched, as if that's a huge deal. And I didn't read that article, you know, in depth. It came from The Guardian, so it was a UK perspective on it. So it was talking about the fact that there's information pertaining to UK, you know, British subjects in there.
Okay, we were talking about the stipulation that the parties reached in the Viacom versus YouTube case, where they're going to anonymize the data, and that's good. I mean, that's what Google's lawyers came back and said they were going to try and do. But what I'm surprised about is that the judge entered such a sweeping discovery order to begin with. I mean, there was no requirement that Viacom agree to that kind of condition.
Well, when we say anonymizing, we mean hiding the IP addresses because we don't know who the individuals are. They just had IP addresses, right?
Right, exactly.
And maybe that's why the judge didn't do it, because judges, you know, while they're aware of the idea of social security numbers being something that should be protected,
That's good. Nikki's back with us. Yes. So, and in fact, wasn't there just a congressional hearing this week, I think, on these sorts of issues? I remember reading some very confused comments by the congresspeople involved as to, you know, what even is an IP address and what are the ramifications of this sort of thing?
It wasn't
the hearing was about with Google, right?
Yeah, I think
Google and Yahoo and the search, right?
Exactly.
I read about that as well.
Yeah. So
one thing that I noticed that was important about that was that Google and Yahoo wanted to have to protect user privacy by keeping the IP addresses anonymous when they were providing that information to the for specific advertising to each user, so that outside of the Google platform, they wouldn't be able to find you as you went everywhere on the web. So I think the anonymity of the IP addresses is an important thing, and Google needs to be aware of that.
Yeah, that was – is there some legislation or something about not being able to track visitors between sites, which is what some of the AOL, you know, platform does and everything else, knowing that you were just at, you know, the Pioneer site, and if you're going to Circuit City website next, that you might want a discount on car audio or something like that.
Right.
Which, you know, could be a terribly useful thing, and you can see why – certainly why sites would want to do it. You can even see why users might want that to happen.
Right.
But those sorts of things, you know, my only thought on those sorts of things is they have to be incredibly crystal clear opt-in.
Right. And, you know, I've never been all that concerned about IP addresses. I mean, some people say that they should be considered as personally identifiable information, others not. I mean, just my personal feeling about this is I don't care too much if Viacom has my IP address or even, you know, just sees those numbers, because if I really were committing copyright infringement through the YouTube service, I would expect that I could, you know, get served with a complaint and summons on it. So I don't know. The jury's still out in my mind. The jury spends a lot of time talking in my mind, so that doesn't mean much. But, you know, on whether it should be, whether one should be all uptight about whether his or her IP address is out there.
That's right. I mean, if you're engaged in an unlawful activity, you have to know, first of all, that it's an unlawful activity, which a lot of people may not know. Secondly, that there are ways to find you and bring you into court.
Right. And I mean,
the reason why you should care. I mean, I agree with you, Evan. I'm pretty lax about my personal privacy because I just figure, you know, like Scott McNeely said, you know, get over it. You don't have much of it. But by the same token, you know, once you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound. I mean, once your IP address is going to be producible or trackable by large, you know, organizations and ISPs and so forth, then anyone who wants it for whatever reason can go get it. And if, you know, if there's copyright infringement occurring at an IP address, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's me doing it, even though I'm here, because there may be other people here as well. That's not good. But if they're going to come after this IP address for child pornography and haul me away in shackles and my name's going to be, you know, front page of the paper, then I am concerned. And so I guess I don't really know how this is all going to play out. And that's where I start to, you know, root for the EFF and for people who challenge these things.
Well, I think the privacy implications are huge, and especially when it comes into the criminal realm, and especially with the government child pornography aside, which is a big thing that they're into prosecuting, and where there's a lot of entrapment issues. That aside, the whole terrorism aspect and who's committing terrorism and who's, you know, doing things that might be considered preparation for terrorism, and the ability that they have to serve these subpoenas like they did with the child pornography in 2006 on the search engines to get all this information and purportedly to use for this one specific purpose, but who knows what else they're using it for, and who else knows how much of it they're maintaining in their databases, the government, and also their idea of what constitutes activity that may be preparation for terror seems to be expanding. And, you know, you would think that you're not doing anything wrong, so you'd be immune. But that's just not the case. It worries me as a criminal defense attorney. And I think I see things from a peculiar viewpoint, but nevertheless, it's worrisome on a large scale basis, I think.
At the same time, we have seen some enhancement of privacy rights. I'm thinking of a couple of cases in particular. Last year, or it may have been in late 2006, there was that case out of the Sixth Circuit. I forget the name of the case, but it had to do with Smiling Bob. You know, it was one of the male enhancement. It didn't have anything to do with that, but it was some kind of fraud case involving that guy.
You got me right there. You had me at Smiling Bob and male enhancement.
You know who I'm talking about. His golf game is improving. And
Yeah, the guy on the late night TV ads.
Yeah. Well, in any event, he was under investigation for fraud. And I know almost nothing about the facts of the case, but what I remember the holding is essentially that there's a Fourth Amendment right to privacy in stored email communications. And it was a bolster to the Stored Communications Act. We saw something quite similar just a couple weeks ago or more out of the Ninth Circuit in the Quan versus Arch Wireless case, I mean, both of those cases stand for, you know, a strong sense of privacy. You know, the EFF and, you know, the folks out there were, you know, applauding the decision in Kwan because of the pro-privacy aspect. So it's interesting to see the balance and, you know, the ebb and flow of things, perhaps.
So as far as just putting some closure on our emailer here who wants to know what companies and organizations need to do in light of the new Discovery Acts, am I gleaning that it's all still very gray and you need to have a lot of consultation with your in-house and outside counsel and just make sure you're not throwing away things that could be relevant to pending or threatened litigation?
Yeah, you need a battle plan and you need to know what your how you're managing your data. I mean, I'll give you an example. Fellow IT guy, high IT guy at a company that you would know, asked me one time if he needed to produce the Outlook archive files that people were putting on the network that he knew that some people were doing, but not everybody did it, and it wasn't officially sanctioned. But he would get discovery requests and. You know, he thought they might or might not be relevant, but because that wasn't part of their standard practice, he didn't envision that that was something that was subject to production, and it is. But, you know, the remedy is for everybody to sit down and figure out what they have, how they manage it, how they want to manage it in light of the federal rules, and when they do manage it, not be perhaps too aggressive in trying to purge the data, because trying to rein that in when you need to rein it in is going to be problematic, even if you're going to be let off the hook. I mean, the problem is you're going to be let off the hook if you're reasonable, but if the other side, you know, finds out you did it, the first thing they're going to do is say it was unreasonable and, oh, look, judge, it was only 7 days. So, you know, you need to have a system in place. That's really what you need.
And I'll tell you one thing that's really helpful, and it has very little to do with the substance or the merits of, you know, your requirements under the law as for preserving data, but it sure can help when you get into the process of collecting electronically stored information and culling through it. And that is just essentially try to have good, and, you know, the term I've used kind of has a funny connotation, but just try to have good digital hygiene. You know, keep your inbox and your archives as free from extraneous matter as possible. You know, if you have an email going back and forth with your colleague saying, let's get together for a meeting at 2 to talk about the project, you know, after that meeting has taken place, you can probably delete that. And in the aggregate, in the composite, you know, that can be several gigabytes of data per year that you can just get out of the picture and don't have to preserve, collect, call through, review for privilege when, you know, if and when litigation comes into play.
We have a new sponsor at This Week in Law. It's GoToMeeting. Online meetings made easy at GoToMeeting.com, GoToMeeting.com. Have your meetings online instead of in person and save time and money. Your travel and expenses go down while your productivity goes up because you're doing more while traveling less. It's very convenient. You can have meetings right from your office, wherever that may be. As long as you have a computer and internet access, you're good to go with multiple users from multiple locations. And you can use it for sales presentations, product demos, training, or collaboration sessions. Anytime you have something on your computer that you want to share with a group, think of GoToMeeting. It's easy. The setup takes just 2 minutes. It's secure. And you get unlimited use for one low, flat monthly rate. In fact, for listeners of this show, if you go to gotomeeting.com/twill, T-W-I-L, you'll get a 30-day free trial, 1 month of free service with unlimited meetings. So please go to gotomeeting.com/twill, check it out, and let us know what you think. So all of this is striking me as important stuff for people to know, but also possibly stuff that is becoming more and more archaic as we speak, as more and more cloud computing services come into our lives and come into the lives of employees at companies who are using them, even though they may be prohibited by company policy from using them. You know, how are people taking into account that some of the relevant data they may need, maybe significant parts of it, aren't going to be where you might traditionally expect them to be, but instead are going to be on Google servers or Yahoo servers or whoever is hosting this web service that people are using?
It certainly adds a layer of complexity to it, and there's no getting beyond that. And something that I've, you know, in the last year and a half have spent some time thinking about is, you know, Rule 34's the scope of what Rule 34 means for a document or electronically stored information to be in the, what is it, the custody, possession, or control of a party. And, you know, the case law seems to come out on the side to say that if you have the legal right to access data or have access to information that's stored by a third party, that's tantamount, or that's, you know, you essentially do have custody, possession, or control under Rule 34. And so, you know, with cloud computing, there's probably no reason to think of it as much of an exception, because there's an end user license agreement or some other kind of legal arrangement between you and your third party data or service provider that gives you the obligation to be able to get this stuff and collect it the same as if it were an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper in your file cabinet in the corner collecting dust.
Yeah, absolutely. But it doesn't address the problem of your employees who want to have the most convenient possible means of communication, and they might not be content with their company issued BlackBerry that's accessing the company servers, and instead they're using their personal Gmail account on their iPhone to transact a certain amount of business.
I see that I just answered the question that I wanted to answer rather than listening to the question.
You politician, you.
I don't know that there is an answer. You know, I mean, I think that what we might start to see in litigation is discovery requests that start to attempt to penetrate employees' personal email accounts for this reason. And we're going to have a whole slew of concerns about that when it starts
to
arise.
Of course. I mean, earliest I remember from this, I know that there are probably cases earlier from this. There was a case in 2005 down in Florida. He was either a teacher or some kind of school employee, had been disciplined by the school, and, you know, they wanted access to his home computer, you know, his hard drives. And this is on my blog somewhere, if you just do the search for terms that might be relevant. But, you know, essentially the court looked at the obvious privacy interests, you know, going to his home computer. There were, of course, privileged communications on that, and, communications with his spouse and all that stuff. So, yeah, it's unsettling, to say the least.
Well, I think it's inevitable, because I think that we're undergoing this blurring of boundaries between the workspace and the personal space. And, you know, as people walk around chained to their electronic devices, there are no boundaries in their own minds as to whether they're at work or whether they're at their son's soccer game. In actual fact, they're at both, if they're taking care of both concerns simultaneously.
Right. And if you're innovative like Ernie is, I mean, something that sticks out from what he wrote within the last couple months is that to be a mobile attorney means to be a paperless attorney. Isn't that what you said? I don't want to mischaracterize what you said, but
yeah, no, exactly.
And so the natural converse, or I guess natural consequence of that, is you're going to have stuff that's digital and it's going to be in a number of different places.
Yep. So that's why we contribute to the EFF.
Yes, generously and often. Okay, let's look at some of the other mail we've received. One that's pertinent to something that's happened just today, actually. We got an email from Sam that said, an episode of Lab Rats discussing EULA and user license agreements made me think of you. I've always wondered how legal stuff in EULAs is. Would they really stand up in court? Has anybody been sued for violating their EULAs? I haven't heard of such a thing. The reason I'm suspicious is I often see things in EULAs that explicitly go against court decisions. One specific example being policies on derivative projects and reverse engineering. The EULA always says you can't do it, but the courts have said you can in some cases. Seems like nothing but intimidation to me. Clearly, the software vendor has a right to refuse to sell you or take back software for any reason, but can they go beyond it and take you to court for further action? So EULAs, you know, are notorious for attempting to be somewhat overbroad and to grant rights that might not be there under the law. And software EULAs have been trimmed and modified by the courts in light of that. Why don't we start from square one and start with Evan, who does in fact, you know, after all, write the Internet Cases law blog. Why don't you tell us about the state of the law on the enforceability of EULAs at the moment?
Well, to say it quickly and, you know, concisely, and to get to the heart of what this person writing this email is talking about, of course, EULAs are enforceable, and they routinely are. And there are a whole slew of court decisions that uphold the validity and the enforceability of end-user license agreements. Make sure we're defining the term we're talking about here.
Right, because EULAs are frequently confused with terms of service and terms of use on the web. And while there are similarities, they're not necessarily the same thing.
Right. I mean, sometimes there can be overlap. And I try not to get too hung up on semantics, but, you know, there are we're essentially talking about a contract here. And in as much as a license to use software or to access, software as a service, in as much as that's a license and as much as that's contractual in nature, you know, the general principles of contract law apply. And, I believe you made reference to something that just came down today. I don't know if what you're talking about is the World of Warcraft decision.
No, I was talking about the SciStar case, if I'm pronouncing that right, where Apple has finally gotten off its duff and sued this Florida company who are installing Mac OS on non-Apple made machines. What's the World of Warcraft thing?
Well, it's kind of a dense opinion, and I haven't read it because, like I said, I was up all night reading the Tiffany versus eBay case. there's a lot going on in the last few days in this space. It's interesting, but essentially, this was a case coming out of the District Court of Arizona, the federal court down there, and Blizzard Entertainment, who is the owner of World of Warcraft, sued a guy. Well, actually, the guy filed the declaratory judgment action against World of Warcraft, saying that he wasn't infringing. World of Warcraft, filed an action for infringement, which is what always happens in these kind of situations. Essentially, what was going on here was I'll just call him the defendant. The guy was making a bot called Glider that allows you to log into World of Warcraft and gain merit automatically. So you can go to work and be gainfully employed, but your computer is at home playing World of Warcraft, getting, swords and pieces of gold and stuff for you and elevating you in status. And World of Warcraft sued for infringement, and its theory was that by, accessing the game in violation of the terms of use, which was the court read in conjunction with the end user license agreement, was making an unauthorized copy of the software by loading it into RAM and playing the game. So the court awarded summary judgment to World of Warcraft on the theory that the purveyor of this Glider software was contributorily and vicariously liable for the infringement of its users, who were committing direct infringement, and they were committing direct infringement because they had violated the end user license agreement / terms of use by accessing the application with a bot. So I guess the decision came out yesterday afternoon, but very recently we have an example of a court finding the end user license agreement perfectly valid and indeed did enforce it, in as much as it granted summary judgment on the issue of contributory infringement.
Wow, that's a great one.
It's interesting.
You could certainly think of instances where a bot would be benign, where it might be beneficial for the user to use a bot for some reason to access a piece of software, not necessarily to game a game, but to do something that allowed for convenience of the user and didn't put an undue load on the software company's servers so as to trigger trespass to chattels kinds of concerns.
Right. Of course, Glide was arguing, its total benign purpose on this. First of all, it was just a minimal disruption on World of Warcraft servers. And also they said, that the disabled could play the game more easily using it, but the court just didn't buy it.
So yeah, in this SciStar case, Apple is contending, among other things, that its end-user license agreement legitimately and validly prevents people from using OS X on anything other than Mac-made hardware, which I think is an interesting assertion from a contractual point of view. I'm not saying that it's unenforceable. I just think that you know, there are some concerns that spring to mind about that. You've purchased a piece of software, you should be able to do with it what you will, you know, as long as it's not somehow nefarious. And I don't know that installing it on an alternate hardware system reaches that threshold.
Right. I mean, clearly you've got to couch it as a cop or as a contract issue if you're the plaintiff in that situation, because you got Section 117 of the Copyright Act, which, you know, gives robust rights to the, you know, the owner of a copy of software to be able to do as he or she wishes to do with it. So, I mean, yeah, the plaintiffs in these kinds of situations are constrained to looking to violation of an end user license agreement, because oftentimes a copyright infringement case is not going to be the best way to go in a situation like that.
Well, and those concerns that you just mentioned, Denise, are similar to the ones that we may be talking about later in terms of the jailbroken iPhones.
Right.
They express a lot of the similar arguments that, you know, you buy the phones and the software and that you can't use it in certain ways. If we do discuss that, we'll...
Yeah, no, actually, we did, and I think you might have been off the call at that point. That's okay.
I missed it.
No, but...
All right.
Yeah, no, you're right that... well, I did want to ask you, because of your criminal background, if you've ever seen... Because, of course, Apple's terms...
Criminal law background. Let's
criminal. Yes, criminal law background. That Apple may be trying to contractually prohibit people from jailbreaking phones. But, you know, of course, the DMCA, if you run afoul of it, has its own criminal provisions as well. Have you ever heard of somebody being criminally prosecuted under the...
There have been some cases a while back. One of them was a Russian guy who came in.
Oh, well, of course.
Copyright infringement case.
Yes. Long ago.
Yeah.
Dimitri
Skylar. I don't think it happens very often.
Yeah, that was 5 or 6 years ago now, the Skylar case.
TechDirt put something up this past week that had a link to some situations that it had to do with. I can't remember if it was a civil action with AT&T, but I know it was. There seems to be a lot of action down in Florida when it comes to this.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's the track. Track phone.
Yeah.
Right. Right. They're the folks that are trying to put folks out of business for selling jailbroken iPhones.
Yeah. And they seem to be doing fairly well with that. So we'll see how that goes.
So, long story short, EULAs are indeed enforceable, but they can't go too far such that they make a contract or include a provision that's unconscionable or maybe illegal for some other reason. And they've been trimmed down by courts for those purposes in the past. And also here in the Ninth Circuit last year, we had a case where this isn't a EULA. This is a website terms of service situation where there was a change to terms of use that was posted on the web, but not otherwise, you know, broadcast out to the users that was... held to be not sufficient notice of a change.
You're talking about the Douglas case?
Yeah, the Douglas case. Did you look at that one closely when it came out, Evan?
Yeah, I think I blogged about it. And to me, that just sounds like good business anyway. It makes sense from a contract law perspective, in as much as, you know, you can't agree to terms that you don't know about, and it's kind of uncool to expect your customers or your users to agree to things that they don't know about. And in the whole bringing it into this notion of how businesses are trying to be more transparent and open, this whole feeling of a more enlightened sense of public relations, it seems to, in my mind, to comport with all of that. It's perfectly reasonable if you're going to insert an arbitration clause or somehow limit your users or your customers' remedy, that they ought to know about it at a minimum. An email would be nice.
Well, so suppose it's not a thing where you have an email relationship with customers, though. Suppose it's just a website changing its terms of use, as they all say that they can at any time, right?
Right. Which after the Douglas case, I would think that provision may not be enforceable.
Right. But so say you've made a change, you don't have an email relationship with the people visiting your site. You just, should they perhaps just put some large conspicuous thing on their homepage that says, hey, we've changed our terms of use. You might want to check it out. I don't, you know, as a practical matter, I don't see that people will do that.
Well, it obviously depends on the facts. And, you know, if you look at the UCC, you know, it says something like, you know, parties can contract. I'm not going to try to quote the UCC by any means, but, you know, something about, you know, they can make an agreement in any manner sufficient to show that there's a meeting of the minds. And so if you're used to communicating with your users by, you know, an updated little spot in the left-hand column, you know, that's where you should put it. Perhaps they just follow you on Twitter, you know, so put out a tweet. I don't know. Email is probably not the silver bullet, but you got to look at the way that's reasonably calculated to inform them of the change.
Right. Hey, Marty, you still with us?
Absolutely.
Oh, good. Because one of the questions I get all the time from people, and one representative email came from listener Ron Plouffe, is what bloggers and podcasters should do to protect themselves from a trademark standpoint. I'm not going to read Ron's whole sad story because it's kind of long, but he has a storytelling podcast called Griddle Cakes Radio, and somebody else began to call their show Griddle Cakes Radio, and it was a different kind of show, and a spat ensued, and let's just say it didn't end in a friendly way. What can folks do, Marty? What should they be doing?
Well, they have two concerns. They want to protect their own name, and they want to avoid infringing anyone else's name. You can own a trademark if you utilize a trademark in commerce, and you might infringe somebody else's trademark if you're using something as a mark in commerce. The name of a podcast or a blog may or may not rise to the level of trademark use depending on how you operate your site. If you are running Google ads or something, conducting commerce in some other way on their site, then it's going to be a fairly clear-cut case that this is just a information service and your name could be protected as a trademark and might be infringing somebody else's. Conversely, if it's just really not much more than some words that you share with friends, then you very well may not be in need of a trademark or worry about infringing other people's. The person who wrote to you obviously was concerned about it, and he was using an arbitrary term. It wasn't something descriptive. In other words, griddle cakes about storytelling, and he was concerned about what he referred to as a not family or workplace safe use of the term griddle cakes. In the real world, that may not be a problem. You know, you could certainly have magazines by the same name if they're in very diverse fields of content, books or other forms of content. They may not ever encounter each other. And on the web, in general, you may not encounter each other. Problem in his case was that for now, there is a certain way a single choke point, namely the iTunes search feature. So someone putting in that name, Griddle Cakes, would encounter the other person. We saw this in the early days of the web, where while the normal rule is there is ordinarily not a likelihood of confusion if there are diverse channels of trade. In the beginning, you had a couple of cases that said, well, you know what, because you have one search engine, it's going to be deemed to be one channel of trade. We got away from that somewhat parochial notion. But still with podcasting, you understand why the guy is upset. You're looking for his podcast and you're going to get this family unfriendly podcast. And interesting to note that in this case, the Griddle Cake storytelling guy wrote to Apple and they obliged. They weren't really legally obligated to, but it's been my experience that if you make a compelling case to them, they can oblige and delist someone from their directory. So he had a happy ending.
Of course, the other people could have gotten outraged and come back after Apple and said this was not fair or warranted and made a stink about it. Maybe they did.
they could have, and Apple as a private entity with a terms of service agreement that you probably have to agree to get your podcast listed with them in the first place, would likely have the upper hand in this sort of situation.
So you think it's different? This podcasting situation may be unique because of the single choke point that Apple de facto has. Of course, there are all kinds of sundry ways to access podcasts, but the predominant directory as we sit here today is iTunes. If this had
aggravating,
been...
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, I think it brings, like the early days of domain names and the early days of search engines, it brings unrelated people into collision with each other, sometimes with unpleasant consequences.
So you think if this had been, you know, a podcast on the one hand and a website on the other hand, we'd be talking about a different kind of scenario and possibly no likelihood of confusion?
Well, as you saw with these cases in the late 90s that stopped holding that the internet was one channel of trade, judges will get more sophisticated and they'll say, look, you know, people are not so knee-jerk. They use these tools and they read the descriptions around them. And at this point, they understand that there could be more than one podcast called Griddle Cakes. And that will not be as important a factor in finding a likelihood of confusion. So in other words, judges take note of the growing sophistication of users.
We hope they do, because that sometimes doesn't happen. But
hey, Marty, this is Evan. Does it depend on the content of the podcast when you're thinking about the likelihood of confusion between the two names given to the podcast?
It only if the content was most likely accessible by the user in making their decision. In making the likelihood of confusion analysis, you look at the ways in which people land on where they land.
So maybe a logo or something might be a more compelling case if it was trying to mimic the other one?
You would have to look at how do people learn that there is a podcast called Griddle Cakes. When they do learn of it, what do they encounter? For example, if the iTunes directory was just sort of a list of names without any other information, then that would favor confusion. But if there was room for a 50-word abstract each time, and you could tell easily from the abstract what the content was, then that would be a fact that would go against confusion. So I would not say that content is as – well, yes, actually content is critical in the case where confusion will continue post making the decision. In other words, once you start listening to the podcast, it's of the subject matter that you had anticipated, so that reinforces your confusion. So I guess the answer to your question is yes, content will be part of the analysis.
And then when you started answering what I just asked, it led me to think about initial interest confusion. And I was wondering if a plaintiff might have some kind of argument there, just seeing these two things in a list, thinking, this might be the one I'm looking for. But then you click on it and find it something different. And it's like a bait and switch kind of thing.
Maybe this is a good opportunity to segue into our Audible ad. Audible is the sponsor of this show and many shows on the TWiT network. I'm a huge fan of Audible books, being as how I'm running around in my car all the time and on planes, and there's just nothing better than being able to take something great to read with you, either for yourself or your children. And audible.com, actually, I think it's kids.audible.com, is their new kids site as well. Tons of great stuff on both sites. And speaking of confusion, I don't know if there's a huge likelihood that you will confuse the movie that's just come out on DVD 21 with the original book, Bringing Down the House, which is available on Audible and is our book pick for the show. Bringing Down the House, the inside story of six MIT students who took Vegas for Millions by Ben Mezrich, which is a fantastic book and just a fascinating story. I really recommend it. So I was very excited. I don't know. Have any of you guys seen the movie 21?
No. I used to watch 21 Jump Street. Is that different?
Yeah, it's different. It's just come out. Well, actually, I don't know if it's still in theaters because I saw it in a hotel and sometimes they get the early release movies. In fact, we were so excited to watch it on 4th of July weekend. And I don't want to trash Kevin Spacey, who is the star and I believe the producer of the movie, because he's a friend of TWiT's and has been on the show before and does this amazing screenwriter incubation kind of site called Trigger Street. But the divergence between the original book, which was great, and the movie, which is a bit over the top, is pretty vast. And Kevin Spacey has a role in the movie that basically wasn't in the book. And, you know, everything just gets sort of bigger and more Hollywood in the movie. And I think it takes away from the original great story of these folks who figured out the way to game the system in the movie. My husband, who spent quite a bit of time in Las Vegas, was just rolling his eyes the whole time saying, you know, oh, that would never happen in a million years. They had all the kids, the MIT kids, you know, staying in these amazing presidential suites in all the hotels. And, you know, somehow they were able to stay under the radar and still continue their card counting scheme, even though they're spending wildly and walking into places arm in arm together as though, you know, they're all one big cadre of folks, which of course, if they were trying to pull off a scheme where they were unrelated entirely and signaling themselves the numbers for the tables. So not the movie, but the book is available on Audible, and that's where I recommend you go to get the real story of Bringing Down the House and the MIT students who figured out a way to make millions in Vegas.
So you're saying in the book they weren't necessarily walking into these places arm in arm with their posse?
No. And, you know, a good deal more subtle and gambling for far lesser amounts of money at a time. There's a scene in the movie where they have a bunch of chips and no way to cash them in without raising eyebrows. And they're sitting in a strip club trying to figure out how to remedy the situation. And the main character figures out, oh, well, you know, we can enlist these strippers to help us cash in the chips because they're constantly cashing in chips as their tips.
So, I'm totally reading this book now, by the way.
Yeah, so it's a good book.
And the best ideas are always, you know, people always come up with them in strip clubs, you know? I find that works for me.
Yeah, when I need to go think. So anyway, you know, he has this great idea of enlisting the strippers' help, but then, you know, the idea is to stay under the radar, right? But the scene then is Kevin Spacey and the main character standing off on the sidelines with huge smiles on their faces as they watch this parade of 25 strippers march through the cashier's window at the casino, each one of them cashing in chips. They may as well have had them then walk over to Kevin Spacey and the main character and hand over a bucket of money, but they didn't quite go that far.
Did Howard Stern get co-screenwriting credit?
I didn't check.
Yeah, most have been written by men.
It sounds like it's definitely a thinking person's work.
Yes. Well, I think the book actually is. and for a little comic relief, you might check out the movie as well. But anyway, I do want to thank you all for joining us on the show today. Nikki Black can be found at Sui Generis. What does that mean in Latin again, Nikki? Enlighten us.
Unique, one of a kind.
One of a kind. Very. But your blog is not one of a kind. You're one of these people who sort of wakes up in the morning and goes, oops, I have a new blog. Because you have a legal humor blog, right? What's that
legal
one?
Legal Antics.
Legal Antics.
That's New York Law Blog, that's typepad.com/legalantics. Then there's my Women Lawyers Back on Track blog, which is also sort of a branch of Sui Generis. And then there's my latest blog, which is group blog, which is slowly getting out of steep, but it's practicing law in the 21st century. And it's about, you know, practicing law and technology and how to fit it into your practice.
That's awesome. I have that problem with waking up in the morning and finding that I've accidentally started a new blog, but you actually update yours with great stuff. And that's unbelievable to me. I've never been able to actually accomplish that part.
Thank you.
And you can also follow Nikki on Twitter. She's Nikki Black with a K on Twitter. So thanks so much for coming on and giving us your insights today.
Thanks. I really enjoyed it.
Good. We'll try and have you back. Ernie Svensson of course, the inimitable Ernie the Attorney at ErnieTheAttorneyNot.net. And I think you're Ernie Attorney on Twitter, correct?
Yes. In those rare moments that I actually appear on Twitter.
Well, few, but much sought after. we're very pleased you could join us again today. Oh, thanks so much for all your insights on discovery and life in general.
It was great to be here.
Evan, really enjoyed having you on the show as our one of our new panelists. Evan writes the Internet Cases Law blog. Anything else you want to plug, Evan? I know you're also Internet Cases on Twitter.
Yeah, that's right. Mainly the blog. You know, I try to focus on that, and then sometimes real work gets in the way. But
what's the name of your firm again? You're with a firm in Chicago?
I'm with Henshaw and Culbertson, and we're based here in Chicago. We have offices nationwide, 27 offices. I'm a big firm guy, you know, as much as I try to also be a human being as well.
That's always a great thing to attempt to pull off. I wish you good luck with it.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me today. It's been a barrel of fun.
Sure, it's been fun for us too. And longtime Twiller Marty Schwimmer, thanks so much for coming on again. You can find Marty Schwimmer as M. Schwimmer on Twitter, M-S-C-H-W-I-M-M-E-R.
I think he's.
Oh, that's right. Marty went into radio silence a little while ago, but you can still find him on Twitter and, of course, at the Trademark blog.
I was going to say that he took up a hobby of, you know, pantomime.
I can almost see him jumping up and down in his office in New York, attempting to flag our attention. I'm sure he's gone off to much bigger and better things, but we do appreciate having him on the show, and you can find him at schwimmerlegal.com online as well. And with that, we'll wrap things up and look forward to getting together again the next time. Thanks so much, everyone.